find one of them. I must have this thing too. And with that, go ahead and welcome Cody T from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Cody Alcoholic.
Oh, thank you, Dale, for inviting me here, and thank you, Lynn, for giving out my phone number, even though you didn't even check with me first. But that's okay. For most of my life, I wasn't asked to do much. When I was around, I was actually the thing I was asked most to do was to leave. So when I'm asked to actually be somewhere and to say something, it is always such an honor. I guess I'll go through the pleasantries. My sobriety date is October 30th, 2011. I'm a part of the Common Solution Group. We meet Thursday nights at 7:30 on Church of Our Savior on Raya Road. That group saved my life when I moved out there 7 years ago. And it's the only home group that I know that all of the same core guys are still there 7 years later. And we also take a meeting to the regional jail on Wednesday nights. Would be great to see some people there. I recognize a few that I've seen there. And I do have a job there. I've cleaned up that meeting every week for the last 7 years of my life. And you'll have to get that job over my dead body. I also swept it for about 6 years until I was threatened to be fired from my sponsor if I didn't give something up in my life. So it's not swept the same. It's not as good as what I would do. And I have taken the broom from time to time. I was kind of like, that's not how you push a broom. Like, come on, man. But yeah, it's a phenomenal group. As I said before, those men have saved my life. And I can't, there's just no words for that. I do have a sponsor, and we are honestly up to date. And I like to actually emphasize the word honestly, because there's been times in my life that I've been up to date, but he didn't know all of it. He knows everything that is going on in my life in real time. And I love that man to death. He will tell me exactly what I don't want to hear when I don't want to hear it. And if you know him, I pushed him to the brink multiple times. And he actually threatened to fire me a couple months ago. And yeah, it takes a lot. And I also have the honor of sponsoring men. It's the closest that I'll ever get to actually seeing that change in me is when I get to sponsor other guys. So got that done. I grew up in a small town called York, Pennsylvania. Some of you guys may know it. It's now a major drug hub for Philadelphia, Harrisburg, Baltimore, and DC. So we were known for two things, extreme obesity and teen pregnancies. So not quite sure how those two coincide, but there we are. That's our claim to fame. And I grew up in a household where this thing was rampant. My father, I'll get to him later on, but he passed from this. My grandfather passed from this. My brother has a frequent flyer miles to the state penitentiary up in PA. He suffers from this. My mother suffers from this. My uncle suffers from this. But it seems like only the Taylor men get the real bad gene of it all, because my mom just is dry as can be. We're the ones, the men side of it, that's like, we're seeing this thing to the damn death. We are taking this thing to the bitter end. End of conversation. This is also going to be a story, and the theme is going to be breaking cycles. There's a lot of cycles that have been broken and have ended with me. We were dirt poor. We were on a welfare for most of my early childhood. We lived in a single room apartment. There was four of us. My first memory was my dad was in a drunken rage blackout. I remember an ashtray being thrown and breaking on the wall. Then I remember going up to my mom, who was leaving with my brother, who was 6 years older, And I remember holding my shoes and asking, "Can you put them on? Can you take me?" And my mom said, "I don't have time for this." And the next thing I know is when somebody's in a drunken rage blackout, they got to take that anger out on someone. I was the last one left. I don't remember what happened after that. It all kind of just went black. And I'm going to talk about this very generally. If you want to talk about it afterwards, I'll be happy to. But I don't want to talk about this type of stuff in an open environment. There was a lot of abuse. And you guys can take that whichever way that you want to take it. If you can imagine the type of abuse, it happened. And growing up, it made me feel as though I wasn't a man. I was never going to grow up to be a man. That I was different than everybody else. And it really warped a lot of my early adulthood and my childhood. So there's multiple times that I would try to go to bed and I'd have to crawl over a passed out dad. My mom just avoided it. And my brother was lucky enough to be her favorite, and he got to avoid a lot of the bad parts of that. When I was 10, my brother, as I said, is 6 years older, started his life of drugs. And I know that this is a totally separate program, but it's a part of my story. And my mom is wildly codependent. And it took all of her time and my dad's time to try to make sure that he survived to see another day. So from about age 10 on, I kind of raised myself. I don't remember coming home to anybody else being home. I don't have memories of my mom or dad sitting down going through schoolwork, frankly, because they didn't understand the schoolwork, because nobody in my family graduated high school. The highest grade, I think, was 10th grade, and that's my extended family. And that's pertinent because of, as I said before, this is about breaking cycles. This is about not living the damn life that I was given and not accepting that as the status quo. Because I could easily be where my brother is in the state pen, but I'm not. And that's through God's grace and my hard, hard ass work in here. So I would come home, nobody was there. Learn how to cook really early, because that's necessary if I planned on actually eating. And that gave birth to really my first love, which was a long distance running. And it is a little bit of a metaphor also, because I was literally running from the problems that were there. And it was also my only ticket out of that place. Was if I could run well enough, I can get a full ride to college somewhere. Only chance I was getting out of that place. So, my first drink, I was 15 or 16. I'm not good with years on when things happened. I can tell you what the weather was that night. I could tell you to the temperature what it was like. It was in October. I can tell you every other detail but the year. I just can't remember years for some reason. I don't know why. And it was at a friend of mine's farmhouse. And I remember I was stuffed up with a cold. And this girl came in with a water bottle, and it was red, Fireball. And I remember she gave it to me, and I took like half of the bottle down. And the first thing I felt was my sinuses cleared. Because it burned like hell. My sinuses cleared up, my nose cleared up. And I was thinking, this is all that I had to do to not feel this sick. And then it hit me. Everything else hit me. I became tall. I became fit. I became attractive. I became funny. I became smart. I could talk about physics with people. I could talk about black holes as to where do we lose the actual information in the black hole? It is not. You know, it's like all that stuff I just instantly knew after I took some drinks. And I remember crashing a four-wheeler into a hill, which takes some skill. I flipped it over I threw crab apples at the guy's house, broke a couple windows, which got some cheers. Then I ended up in somebody else's car about a half a mile away with no pants on. And I thought, hot damn, this is the life. But I gotta wait because I have to run. I can't let this get in my way. I have to do this. So I finished school. I got a full ride to a school for cross country and track. And they were really looking forward to it, of like, this guy's going to really do a lot of great things for us. Because all of my times in my like 10th year were better than their times. And they were like, all right, so we got this guy. Let's see what happens. First night there on campus, they have something called mixers, where women and guys get together, drink out of a keg, and have a good time. And I remember showing up to this house, and it was a trash hole, and going downstairs, and I see a keg. I didn't leave the keg. I held on to the like nozzle the entire night. And I thought, I could wake up at 5 a.m. and run 15 miles. Or, other side of things, I can get drunk and hang out with a lot of good-looking women. You guys can guess which one won on that. Something about if you don't live up to your side of the scholarship, they take it from you. I didn't show up to a single practice. I stayed in that basement. I stayed with those people. And while everybody else could still function and still make practice, still do their end of the bargain, I couldn't. And that's what separated me from them. So, finished my first semester, and I got a bill for the first semester. And I'm thinking, but this is supposed to be a full ride, guys. Like, I don't get a bill for this. Like, you guys are supposed to pay for me to be here. And that was when that was explained of if you don't show up to stuff, we can't pay for you just to not show up. So spent about 2 years there. Didn't really do it. And I was just looking for a way out of there. So at around that time, my mom lost her job. And I took that as a sign of I need to go home. I need to get a full-time job. I need to support this family. I left that school thinking that I owed them tens of thousands of dollars. I didn't think I ever paid anything. Like, this was all uncharted territory for me. I didn't have a dad to reach out to be like, what about student loans? What about student aid? I didn't have a mom that I could reach out to. I didn't have an uncle I could reach out to. Which is a funny story about, not really funny, but my uncle, he actually had somebody die in his bed from an OD. So I'm really set up with the gene pool on this one. So came back home, and that's when it really took off because I reunited with a lot of the high school kids that didn't do anything with their lives, that all kind of just stayed there and drank. And my first trying at sobriety was July 7th, 2009. I was 22, and it came on the legs of a really bad incident at Sheets. So when I get drunk, I take everything as a slight. I take everything as, you're not looking at me right, Bobby. It's like, this is going to be an issue. Like, I take everything as an issue. So that night was a highlight dollar beer. That's how far back this was. They still had dollar beer night. And I remember my tab was like 14 or 15 bucks. And I only drank the dollar beers. And my idea was, I got to leave before I get drunk so I can drive before this all hits me. So I was with a friend of mine named Kevin. And I'm hungry. I'm always hungry. I'll eat anytime. So we go to Sheets, and my go-to is always hot dogs and French fries with ranch. I'm a little weird. I don't know what to tell you guys. So I remember standing there, and for some reason, I had it in my mind that these three guys took my food, and I'm not going to stand for it. So I followed them outside, and I was like, "What? Why are you taking my food?" And they had no idea what I was talking about. Finally, I goaded one of them into swinging at me, and I just took the punch. And this is all third hand from my friend Kevin telling me as to what happened. And he was like, they just stood there in marvel of like, what's this guy on? So I, of course, swung back because I finally goaded him into it. And they didn't have my food. I don't know whatever happens to those hot dogs, but I'm sure somebody ate them and somebody had a very good evening with them. So we go back to my apartment. There's also a night that we played like I think we egged one of our old teachers' houses. That's how mature we were at that stage. It was like, let's get this guy from 7th grade. It's like 22-year-old man right there. And I remember the story because again, this is my life according to my perspective. Some of the stuff didn't happen. Some of it did happen, but not the way that I remember. And a lot of stuff happened that I don't remember. And I remember going into my apartment and I stumbled into the wall and I passed out on the floor. Little fast forward and I'll come back. I was telling my story at about 2 years sober and Kevin was there. He stayed sober from that night on because I didn't fall into my wall. Have you guys ever watched Jersey Shore? The situation when he launches himself into the wall head first. That's what I did. With about a 10-foot running start and launched myself into the wall head first, knocked myself unconscious right away. And he said that he saw God for the first time when that happened. And he thought to himself, what in the hell am I doing here with this guy? As I'm laying face first on the ground, passed out. He's still sober. Like it's wild. I check in with him like about every year at around our times, and it's amazing. He got me to change groups when I first came back. And he's another guy that will always have a special place for me. So there was my first go at this thing. And I'm thinking, all right, I'll go in. I'll chill out for a bit. I will then identify out because that's what I'm going to do here. I'm not really invested in this. I just want to, not knock myself unconscious anymore. That lasted about 5 months, and I went back to drinking, and that started a very, very rapid decline of 3 years. Very rapid. Or 7708. Yeah, that was the first date. So yeah, about 3 years of a very, very rapid decline. Most people's drinking kind of just gradually gets worse over time. Mine went just straight vertical line. And so, all right, I got time. So the night of October 29th, 2011. If you've ever been held at gunpoint, you might understand the story. If you didn't, might not be able to help you with that one. But the year prior in 2010, I was dressed up as Quail Man. I don't know if you guys remember Quail Man from the cartoon series Doug. But if you do, it'll be a lot funnier than if you don't. If you don't, this is just going to be tragic. But if you do, it's gonna be tragically funny. So I'm dressed up as Quail Man, the underpart, and my friends dropped me off at my apartment. They say that I went in, but I come to in somebody else's house, like four apartments down, and the guy has a gun out. And he's like, "Who are you? What are you doing here? And why aren't you leaving?" And I come to and I look around and I go, huh, this isn't my apartment, is it? This guy with his daughter in his arm is like, you need to leave. So of course I go, all right, I'll leave. But where is 695 East Philadelphia Street from here? Because I need to know where I'm going. And he goes, I'm not going to tell you twice. And I said, fair enough. And I walked back and I realized I was like three houses, four houses down. Just walked right back inside. So that was gunpoint number one. So, and I argued this with my first sponsor a lot. I was like, you've never been held at gunpoint? Not even once? And it was like, no. And I go, not even once? I thought that was a common thing. I thought it was special because it happened twice on like back to back years to the date. So on October 29th, 2011, I decided to mix some stuff. It was a fifth of 151 and Klonopin. And I only bring that up because that's a part of how I got back here. And that stuff rocketed me, and I could time travel on that stuff. I could only time travel forward. I couldn't time travel back, and I could teleport because I'd just end up places and I'd be like, how did I get here? And they would say, how did you get here? And we'd have a nice little talk about how I got there. So, excuse me. I was dating somebody at the time. I like to call her the practice wife or the first prisoner that I really took. Dating her for about a year, and she lived with her parents about 90 minutes away. So I down the fifth, I take a couple of the other stuff. And who doesn't want to see charming old me at this stage at around midnight? I mean, obviously everybody wants to see me at that stage because I'm an attractive, charismatic man. I mean, her parents would love for me just to show up. So I drove there and I woke up on their basement floor. And they had like a key lock, and I don't know how I got in because I didn't know the key. So I don't remember how I got into the house. And I wake up and I'm like, this looks familiar this time. So that's progress. At least I know where I am now. And I remember I'm about half of a push-up up when I look over to the couch, and there's your dad with a rifle. And he's just sitting there with it. And he goes, I don't know what the hell you are, but you need to leave and leave our family alone. And I just laughed. And I laughed because I felt different. And I don't know of anybody that's ever planned their sobriety date. I don't know anybody that was like, all right, Thursday, June 26th, I'm gonna get sober. That's it. I believe that it has to be a spontaneous spiritual experience. It needs to just happen. It can't be something that I plan. It can't be something, well, I guess I did technically work towards it, but it's not something that is, it's just gonna be a random, spontaneous thing. And the beautiful thing about this program is that it can be, I've heard people of spilling wine on their $1 million carpet to a guy serving his ninth jail term to somebody backing up their Benz into their other Benz and like, oh, I need to stop. But I worked those first three steps in about 2.5 seconds. I felt different. The world looked different to me, and I can't explain it. The only way that you would understand is if you felt the same thing. But the world was different. It was kind of like going from cable to like 4K. Everything was more vibrant, everything was more clear. And I remember going, yes, George, I need to go do some stuff. And he said, yeah, you do. And don't come back. Now, notice that I said ex-wife. So, a little precursor for that. So, I went back to the same meetings that I was going to before. And it wasn't an easy place to find. It was a back alley, down another back alley, around another building. And I just remembered where to go. And I showed up there. I still had blood, still had vomit on me. I was crying because I spent like the first like 90 days crying. When I was at work, I would use the like large stall because that was the only stall that you couldn't look through the little space in the door and see the toilet because it's off to the side, and I would cry. I don't know. Yeah, I cried a lot this first 90 days. And I just started crying as soon as I got there. And then anger came over me because those same people were there. And I'm thinking, how? How did you get on without me? Like, I wasn't here, but you guys were. I thought that everything ended when I left, but you guys are still, you have a kid now? You bought a house? I'm trying to not get shot. Massive difference between the way that they were living. My first sponsor, was named Troy. And I don't remember what the topic was that night. All I remember is that I sat on a really crusty couch in the back and I cried. And Troy came up to me afterwards and said, I can't promise you life will get better. I can't promise you a house. I can't promise you a job. I can't promise you anything. But what I can promise you don't have to feel this way ever again. And I haven't felt that way since. I was suicidal. Every day I woke up, I would go to the bathroom and I would think, why am I still here? Why couldn't God give me that stage four cancer instead? Like, why couldn't God crash my car into a tree? Why am I still here living a life that I don't want to live? And there's good people out there that aren't. And that was a big bout that I had with this whole idea of God. Huge bout with it. Because I was using a kindergarten version of what God was, a Santa Claus version, as some people would say. Like, well, if God is real, then why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? It was very childish, the way that I came in looking at God. So I started the steps right away. My first, fourth, and fifth step at the time was very haphazard. And it wasn't even really done. It was in his car. And he said, this is a couple weeks into it. And he said, excuse me. Son, something's killing you. What is it? I was like, I don't really want to talk about it. And he goes, well, of course you don't want to talk about it. That's why I'm asking. What is it? Because he said that. I can just tell in your eyes something is killing you from the inside. And you haven't told anybody. And I don't know how he knew, but he knew. And I just let it out. I let out about the abuse. I let out about how I felt different. I let out about I'm not going to be able to be loved because this happened. And once she finds out that this happens, she's gone. Or if my friends find out that this happened, they're gone. That's how I felt. And he goes, kind of chuckled a bit and goes, yeah, man, you and about a third of the room. And I thought, what? Yeah, about you, me, and about a third of the room. It was the first time in my life that I felt a part of. First time in my life that I could take off that scarlet letter and look at myself and be like, I'm not different. Then he said, it happened. If you weren't there and somebody else was, it would have happened to them. It's not your fault that this happened. And that took off a lot of the anger. Was like, if anybody else was in my place, it would have happened to them. It wasn't just me that it happened to. And that didn't make sense for years. So I was sober for about 6 months. And I'm living with that girl that her dad said to never come back to. And I do owe her a lot because she helped me at the very beginning. And I don't think I'd be standing here if she didn't spend those first couple of years with me. I honestly, God, don't think I would have made it without her support. So I was working about an hour away, and she calls frantically crying. And I had a dog that I found as a stray when I was in third grade. And I remember looking at him because it was the only time that I ever went to the post office by myself, literally the only day that I went to the post office. And I remember looking out the door, and there's this dog just sitting there staring at me. And for some reason, I said out loud, "Oh, nobody loves you too, huh?" Because he was abandoned, collar on and all. Nobody claimed him. He was abandoned just like I felt abandoned. And he was the only constant in my life for all those years, was my dog. And she calls me frantically crying. And she's just like, "He fell down the stairs. I can't pick him up." And I'm screaming, "Pick up the effing dog. Just pick him up. He's like 50 pounds. Aren't you strong enough to pick up the dog?" Knowing in the back of my head what happened. I'm like, "Just pick up the dog. Like 50 pounds. You can do this. Use your legs. Lift from the bottom up and get the dog up." So I made it to the emergency vet, and he had a massive stroke. And we could have kept him, but he was gone. His eyes just kept going back and forth. He was gone. And it was one of the few times in my sobriety that I was like, "This is really not worth it. What's the point? What's the point of me doing all this? What's the point of me sponsoring these guys? What's the point of me driving these people to these meetings if they take the one thing that was closest to me? What's the point? What's the point of God? What's the point of any of this if he's taken from me?" And I found out one of the first major lessons of this program, because the fellowship that I received after that was incredible. And it's also at around the same time that Kevin was like, "Hey man, I go to this group in Dover, PA. They're all a bunch of old dudes and they're militant about this thing. You should probably join us one night." And I was like, because one of my first meetings, and I got to tell this quick story. This is fantastic. So a couple of weeks in, I'm sitting there and a guy from Papa John's comes in with a pizza and he goes, "Who got the large pepperoni?" And this dude in the back goes, "I did." And he drops off the pizza to the guy. And I'm thinking, where am I? And this is fantastic. And I've appreciated that moment more and more as I got sober longer. As in, that guy was a baller. That guy was, he did his program. He was hungry, so he ordered a pizza. The longer I'm sober, the less I knock the guy. Because there's been so many times I've been sitting in there going, "I could really go for a pizza right now." And I'm getting cranky. That guy noticed. So he ordered one. Like, boy, I wish I could shake that guy's hand. Also, in like my first week, there was a guy named Smiling Bob. No longer called Smiling Bob, just Bob now. And he got up to the front of the room and said, "Hey, everybody, I stole all the money from the treasury." And I'm just like, "So are we gonna stab this guy or what?" Like, who's got the knife? Like, this is what we do. We shank him quick. And he's like, "And I'll pay it back. I'm sorry. I wanted to tell everybody." And they clapped. I'm like, we're clapping a thief. We're applauding a thief. That didn't make sense to me until years later as to why that was so important and why that was incredibly brave for him to stand up in front of everybody and be like, "Yeah, I stole the money. Here's my plan to pay it back." So the fellowship around me was incredible. I didn't spend a single moment by myself. People would stay the night, sleep on the couch just to make sure that I wasn't alone. And it was those guys in Dover that would drive the 30 minutes to my house just to be there because they knew how bad off I was. And the fact that I was the only person under 70 to have showed up to that meeting in about a decade. So they were really hard, like, this guy needs to stay, everybody. We can't let him go. We have one other guy, and he's already like 6 years sober. He's good, but this guy's new. Like, we need him. And it just felt incredible. So about 2 years or so, I got married to that girl. And when her dad walked her down the aisle, he said he couldn't imagine a better man taking care of his daughter. Go back 2 years prior, and he's threatening to shoot me and to get out of here. That's not me. That's not me. I didn't do that. It was God in this that did that. It was God in this program that made me take accountability for my actions and ownership and make amends and go through that deep and dark shit that I didn't want to ever talk about. And that deep and dark stuff, I can't tell you how many guys I've talked to about that. One-on-one, them feeling the same way as I did, thinking nobody understands. I need to go to a totally different meeting for us while everybody else gets sober. And when the book talks about, or I'm going to paraphrase, I stopped being the whole big book thumper. It's not very attractive to people. that our deepest, darkest past will become our greatest gifts. And I thought that was stupid it became one of my greatest gifts. We got married and we moved down to Richmond for my job. And out of my amends, I didn't make one amends. I held on to that one. I held on to it. And that was my dad. And I want to talk about briefly about amends. Definitely wouldn't recommend making them right away, but I would definitely recommend not waiting forever to do them. We have a finite time on this earth. I saw him multiple times in person and I didn't do it. There's one time at a gas station that he actually held the door open for me and he didn't recognize me. That's how far gone he was. There's one time we were at the mall and my wife at the time said, "Holy shit, look at that guy." And I said, "That's my dad." And she's like, "No, he's not." I was like, "Oh, that's I'm not gonna lie about this one, honey." Can't you see our fingers? The same sausage fingers. That's my dad. And I got a call from my mom, and she's like, "Your dad passed. He was dead for 3 days in his apartment before anybody saw him." That's another important message that I want to give is that if I stay in this, I'm going to die alone. Nobody's going to want to be around me. Water seeks its level. Water always seeks its level. And if I'm hanging out with the dregs of society, the dregs of society aren't going to be there for me when I'm in need. And I said, "All right, I guess I got to travel. I guess I got to go up to PA and I got to take care of the funeral because my brother enjoys the state pen too much." And went up there and took care of everything. And it was the first time in my life that my selfish and self-centered worldview was smashed. It was the first time in my life that I looked at people, not just their relationship with me, but them as people. It was the first time that I saw my mom as a wife, as a daughter, as a friend, as a cousin, as an aunt. I saw her as a person and not just her relationship with me. And it was ridiculous. I'm like, "Holy crap, she interesting." I always thought that she was just my mom. Like that was her only job in the world, just to be my mom. And when I did my 8-step list, my sponsor had me put it into different columns: the now, the later, the nevers. And I had a fourth column, my dad. Like he was never going to graduate up the scale from the never to later to now. It just isn't going to happen. The stuff he did to me, the expectations that I had of him to provide for the family, to be smarter, to be a man, to be a good man, he failed at every single one of those. And when I was standing over his body, I was with my mom, and all of that anger went away because I looked at him and it hit me of stuff that I was telling so many sponsees and people at the podium that I would get up here and I would say, people do the damn best with what they have at any given moment. While I'm sitting in the third row thinking, my dad's a piece of crap because he never gave me enough. I was talking a lot for the first couple of years. If there's anything in the book in the first 164, I could guarantee you I could quote it backwards. I wasn't doing any of the walk at all. And it was the time that it hit me of like, if my dad could have done better, he would have done better. And it was my expectations of what I viewed a father should be that was failed. He didn't fail me. My expectations of what I thought he should be on a daily basis failed me. And Bill talks about it in his letter to the Grapevine about emotional sobriety. And it's a fantastic one. It's in A Language of the Heart. I would highly recommend reading it. Highly recommend. It's about 2.5 pages long. And it talks about expectations. And if we place our security, our self-worth into somebody else or something else other than God, it's going to fail us 100% of time. And it's failed me every single time that I've done that. Repeatedly, I put my worth in the her, put my worth into that corner office with its own thermostat, couches, and two walls of windows. That's when you made it in the corporate world. That's when you've made it. All of those things are gone. What's here is you guys in the program. So, and that was also the time that my grandmother, my dad's mom, gave me the greatest compliment I ever received in my life. She said, "You turned out to be such a good man." And I have no idea how. And that happened over 10 years ago. And there's nothing you could tell me about me that's going to make me feel better than that. It's the first time in my life that somebody else was like, I showed up and I was a solid guy at the funeral. I made sure that everybody else was okay. It didn't matter about my personal feelings anymore. I was a part of and not the whole. So I always cry at my dad part. Funny thing is that I actually picked up my 10-year chip on his birthday and I just broke down crying. I don't even think I said a word during it. I just cried the entire time. I was like, thanks, everybody. I'm just going to go cry in the back now by myself. So during this time, I went back to school because my first sponsor looked at me and said, "You're not getting sober just to get by anymore, man. You need to finish what you started. This isn't a program of doing half-assed stuff," which I always thought it was, and I actually have a little bit more fun when I do it sometimes. So I went back and I finished undergrad. I finished at the top of my class. I went to school full-time year-round for 6.5 to 7 years. And also promoted in the corporate world. Then I went to grad school and I finished that. And my mom, when you walk into her house, the first thing you see is a Washington State University Master's of Business Administration, Cody Taylor. First thing you see. That doesn't happen to guys like me. That doesn't happen to guys that wake up at gunpoint, that live off of welfare, that have the genes that I have. It doesn't happen for guys like me. I'm not supposed to be here. And to go from a family, and I'm talking extended family, that didn't finish high school, to going through grad school. Then I thought about a doctorate, but a doctorate in finances seems to be more miserable than drinking. But that was all this. That was all AA. That was all my fellowship. That was all God that gave that talent and gave that work ethic. And also the fact that somebody at Comcast years back said that I wouldn't make it in finance, and I held a grudge for years. I actually had an office right next to his. And the first thing I did, right next door, going, "Hey, you don't remember me." However, I didn't make it. And he was like, "This guy's insane. He's weird, and I don't like him." All those things and that grudge kind of helped, kind of really spurred it for me. I got time. So, trying to think of where I'm at. So, a couple years later, my wife, I'm home, and she looks at me and says, "I'm not happy." And I said, "Well, then get out. Problem solved, isn't it?" And she's like, "You don't want to fix this?" I'm like, "You said the magic word, you're not happy. You're never going to be happy." She got sober at the same time I did, but she started to go back out. And we grew massively apart. We had different interests. We had different ideas as to where our life were going. And it was over. And again, all my friends and family in here, because family's changed word, has changed meanings to me. I can pick who my family is. I can't pick who my relatives are. There's a big difference between the two. They're all there. And one guy actually offered to bury, because she was seeing somebody else, to bury a deep enough hole in the marsh near his house that we could go get the guy, kill him, and then bury him. And he promised that we wouldn't get caught. But I was like, I don't think murder is really anywhere in the steps of what I should be doing for this. But not a bad idea, actually. So at that time, I moved out to Charlottesville. I got a promotion where I was at, and life was going great. Life was going great. Then about a couple years ago, there's something that a lot of us talk about, the second surrender. I've had the third surrender also kind of recently too, but we're not going to talk about the third one, just the second one. When, because all that time that I spent in school, I was running from a lot of the issues in my life. I was running from being dry. I figured if I stayed busy long enough, all of those feelings would just go away. Not actually going back through the steps, going back through the amends process, sponsoring more people, showing up to more meetings. I thought if I just ran away again, things would just get okay. And they didn't. And at the time, I was with somebody. She was beautiful. She was smart. Like on paper, she was a 10 out of 10. Like you couldn't write out a better partner than what she was. I was making more money than what I could spend. Like I was literally out trying to spend the stuff that I was making and I couldn't. And I was miserable. I hated everybody in here. I would sit down and I would think, well, he's going to share and he's going to say some dumb crap. She's going to share and say some dumb crap. This one I could probably play bingo with because she says the same thing over and over and over again, that I could make up some like bingo cards and we could have a game. This guy, I never want to hear from ever again. I don't know why he's here. He doesn't work the program at all. And I remember just sitting there and I'm like, I hate my life so much. On paper, it's perfect. On paper, it's the perfect life. On the inside, it was miserable. And shocker, she left me. Surprising. You don't want to be around somebody that's always miserable. I didn't get that message. Also, left the job. And I remember calling my current sponsor now. I was on my way to Buckingham Tuesday night. Fantastic meeting. Another one that I went to for the first couple of years that I moved to Charlottesville. And I really got to know a lot of people very well. Highly recommend if you're ever available on Tuesday and you want to take a drive. Highly, highly recommend it. And I remember telling him, well, I feel as though God abandoned me. And he said, God did abandon you. And I'm like, that's not what you're supposed to say on the other side, bro. Like, you're supposed to be like, God's always there for you. Keep seeking. And I was like, what? Then he said, because you changed what God was. God's not love and kindness, because that's how I feel God is. God is love and kindness. If I'm loving and kind to the people around me, things just make sense. The world is better. I feel better. Everything is better. And I replaced it with her. I replaced it with the job. I replaced it with money. Again, the passage that Bill writes about emotional sobriety, I could replace all of the pronouns with my name. And he goes, you got to get back into this thing, dude. I've been seeing you struggle for a while, and I can't step in. I need to let you learn these lessons the way that you're learning them. I said, well, thanks. You could have just, softened that blow a bit. I thought that was your job, dude. Then I said a few choice words to him, and I had to make amends for that. Quick story about amends. So I made an amends with a guy that I grew up with about 2.5 years. It was before I moved down to Richmond. So it was like 2.5 years sober. And he said, all right, well, that's great that you're doing well. But for this to be finished, I'm gonna need you one day. And you must be there when I need you. And I'm thinking, whatever, dude. Sure, cross off the list. Like, idiot. Like, I was in like year eight, it was like 6 years later. It was a Friday. I was in Philly for work. And he calls me and he's like, my wife's cheating on me. And I said, okay. And there was this awkward silence. And I'm thinking, please don't remember. Please don't remember what I agreed to years ago. Please don't remember. Then he said, you remember? And I said, oh crap. And he didn't even finish it. And I said, all right, man, I'll be there. It'll be like 3 hours, but I'll be there. And I spent the entire weekend with him. Because that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to live up to my ends of this stuff. And I really haven't talked to him afterwards, which is odd. But I feel as though that was the perfect ending to a childhood friendship that I lived up to my end. And I said that I would do something and I did it. Where I'm at today, because I'm at 55 or so, 56, sorry. Where I'm at today, life's perfect. I have no issues that are worth mentioning. I have beautiful people in my life. I have people who, and I highly recommend getting people that are going to be honest with you. No matter how they hurt your fifis, they're going to be honest with you. And I have a lot of friends that would tell me, you ain't doing this thing right, man. You're acting out. You're selfish. You're mad. You're self-centered. I don't want to be around you. I have people that will point out, you're not treating her right. You're not treating them right. You're not working hard at work. You're just stealing a paycheck from them. I need that. I need people to help hold myself accountable. The cycles that are broken, I don't have to be the same dad that my dad was. My son is always going to know how much I love him at all times. He can do whatever it is that he does, and boy, does he piss me off some days. He just does not listen whatsoever, and I just want to ring him some days. But he knows how much I love him, and he doesn't go very long without me reminding him how much I do. I'm never going to strike him, no matter what he does. It doesn't ever constitute striking him. I'm going to support him throughout everything. Another cycle broken. Generational poverty. My family throughout the whole generations have been impoverished. They've been on welfare. That ends. That ended with me. And that will continue to end. Because I will work myself into the ground to make sure that my son does not have to endure the stuff that I endured. Making something of myself. That changed. Changed. I finished undergrad and grad. It wasn't easy. It's not for the faint of heart. It's not for the weak. It's not for the weak-minded. There was many, many nights that I was up until 3 a.m. looking at finance stuff that didn't make any damn sense to me and still doesn't. But I was not quitting. This program does not teach me to quit on things. And I want to finish with one thing, because Bill says it so much better than what I could. And it's the ending of Bill's story. It's the last three paragraphs. And it goes, as an alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath, there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend, simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. Damn, Bill said it perfectly. Thank you, guys.
Cody, thank you. That was a great, honest AA talk. And thanks, Gary, for coming with them for support. Hey, everybody. My name is Bryce. I'm an alcoholic.
Bryce.
I'm going to pass the basket around that I don't have up here. Taylor's got it in the back. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While the basket is being passed, we do have a website here, the Blue Ridge Speakers Group.com, where you